Moby Dick, or the Whale, by Herman Melville. Chapter 71. The Jeroboam's Story. Hand in hand, ship and breeze blew on, but the breeze came faster than the ship, and soon the Pequod began to rock. By and by, through the glass, the stranger's boats and manned mastheads proved her a whale ship. But as she was so far to windward, and shooting by, apparently making a passage to some other ground, the Pequod could not hope to reach her. So the signal was set to see what response would be made. Here be it said that, like the vessels of military marines, the ships of the American whale fleet have each a private signal, all which signals being collected in a book with the names of the respective vessels attached. Every captain is provided with it. Thereby the whale commanders are enabled to recognize each other upon the ocean, even at considerable distance, and with no small facility. The Pequod's signal was at last responded to by the stranger's setting her own, which proved the ship to be the Jeroboam of Nantucket. Squaring her yards, she bore down, ranged a beam under the Pequod's lee, and lowered a boat. It soon drew nigh, but as the side ladder was being rigged by Starbuck's order to accommodate the visiting captain, the stranger in question waved his hand from his boat's stern in token of that proceeding being entirely unnecessary. It turned out that the Jeroboam had a malignant epidemic on board, and that Mayhew, her captain, was fearful of infecting the Pequod's company. For though himself and the boat's crew remained untainted, and though his ship was half a rifle shot off, and an incorruptible sea and air rolling and flowing between, yet conscientiously adhering to the timid quarantine of the land, he peremptorily refused to come into direct contact with the Pequod. But this did by no means prevent all communications. Preserving an interval of some few yards between itself and the ship, the Jeroboam's boat, by the occasional use of its oars, contrived to keep parallel to the Pequod as she heavily forged through the sea, for by this time it blew very fresh, with her main topsail aback, though indeed at times by the sudden onset of a large rolling wave, the boat would be pushed some way ahead, but would be soon skillfully brought to her proper bearings again. Subject to this and other, the like interruptions now and then, a conversation was sustained between the two parties, but at intervals not without still another interruption of a very different sort. Pulling an oar in the Jeroboam's boat was a man of a singular appearance, even in that wild, wailing life where individual notabilities made up all totalities. He was a small, short, youngish man, sprinkled all over his face with freckles, and wearing redundant yellow hair. A long-skirted, cabalistically cut coat of a faded walnut tinge enveloped him, the overlapping sleeves of which were rolled up on his wrists. A deep, settled, fanatic delirium was in his eyes. So soon as this figure had been first described, Stubb had exclaimed, "That's he! That's he! The long-togged Scaramouche, the town whose company told us of!" Stubb here alluded to a strange story told of the Jeroboam and a certain man among her crew, some time previous when the Pequod spoke the town ho. According to this account, and what was subsequently learned, it seemed that the Scaramouche in question had gained a wonderful ascendancy over almost everybody in the Jeroboam. His story was this. He had been originally nurtured among the crazy society of Niskayuna Shakers, where he had been a great prophet, in their cracked secret meetings having several times descended from heaven by the way of a trap door, announcing the speedy opening of the seventh vial, which he carried in his vest pocket, but which, instead of containing gunpowder, was supposed to be charged with laudanum. A strange apostolic whim having seized him, he had left Niskayuna for Nantucket, where with that cunning peculiar to craziness, he assumed a steady, common-sense exterior, and offered himself as a green-hand candidate for the Jeroboam's whaling voyage. They engaged him, but straightway upon the ship's getting out of sight of land, his insanity broke out in a freshet. He announced himself as the Archangel Gabriel, and commanded the captain to jump overboard. He published his manifesto, whereby he set himself forth as the deliverer of the Isles of the Sea and vicar general of all Oceanica. The unflinching earnestness with which he declared these things, the dark daring play of his sleepless, excited imagination, and all the preternatural terrors of real delirium united to invest this Gabriel in the minds of the majority of the ignorant crew with an atmosphere of sacredness. Moreover, they were afraid of him, as such a man, however, was not of much practical use in the ship, especially as he refused to work except when he pleased. The incredulous captain would fain have been rid of him, but apprised that that individual's intention was to land him in the first convenient port. The Archangel forthwith opened all his seals and vials, devoting the ship and all hands to one conditional perdition, in case this intention was carried out. So strongly did he work upon his disciples among the crew, that at last in a body they went to the captain and told him if Gabriel was sent from the ship, not a man of them would remain. He was therefore forced to relinquish his plan. Nor would they permit Gabriel to be in any way maltreated, say or do what he would, so that it came to pass that Gabriel had the complete freedom of the ship. The consequence of all this was that the archangel cared little or nothing for the captain and mates, and since the epidemic had broken out, he carried a higher hand than ever, declaring that the plague, as he called it, was at his sole command, nor should it be stayed but according to his good pleasure. The sailors, mostly poor devils, cringed, and some of them fawned before him in obedience to his instructions, sometimes rendering him personal homage as to a god. Such things may seem incredible, but, however wondrous, they are true. Nor is the history of fanatics half so striking in respect to the measureless self-deception of the fanatic himself as his measureless power of deceiving and bedeviling so many others. But it is time to return to the Pequod.
"I fear not thy epidemic, man," said Ahab from the bulwarks to Captain Mayhew, who stood in the boat's stern. "Come on board."
But now Gabriel started to his feet.
"Think, think of the fevers, yellow and bilious. Beware of the horrible plague." "Gabriel, Gabriel," cried Captain Mayhew, "thou must either—"
But that instant a headlong wave shot the boat far ahead, and its seethings drowned all speech.
"Hast thou seen the white whale?" demanded Ahab when the boat drifted back. "Think, think of thy whaleboat, stoven and sunk. Beware of the horrible tale. I tell thee again, Gabriel, that—"
But again the boat tore ahead as if dragged by fiends. Nothing was said for some moments, while a succession of riotous waves rolled by, which by one of those occasional caprices of the seas were tumbling, not heaving it. Meantime, the hoisted sperm whale's head jogged about very violently, and Gabriel was seen eyeing it with rather more apprehensiveness than his archangel nature seemed to warrant. When this interlude was over, Captain Mayhew began a dark story concerning Moby Dick, not, however, without frequent interruptions from Gabriel whenever his name was mentioned, and the crazy sea that seemed leagued with him. It seemed that the Jeroboam had not long left home when, upon speaking a whale ship, her people were reliably apprised of the existence of Moby Dick and the havoc he had made. Greedily sucking in this intelligence, Gabriel solemnly warned the captain against attacking the white whale, in case the monster should be seen, in his gibbering insanity pronouncing the white whale to be no less a being than the Shaker God incarnated, the Shakers receiving the Bible. But when, some year or two afterwards, Moby Dick was fairly sighted from the mastheads, Macy, the chief mate, burned with ardor to encounter him, and the captain himself, being not unwilling to let him have the opportunity, despite all the archangel's denunciations and forewarnings, Macy succeeded in persuading 5 men to man his boat. With them he pushed off, and, after much weary pulling and many perilous, unsuccessful onsets, he at last succeeded in getting 1 iron fast. Meantime, Gabriel, ascending to the main royal masthead, was tossing 1 arm in frantic gestures, and hurling forth prophecies of speedy doom to the sacrilegious assailants of his divinity. Now, while Macy, the mate, was standing up in his boat's bow, and with all the reckless energy of his tribe, was venting his wild exclamations upon the whale, and essaying to get a fair chance for his poised lance, lo, a broad white shadow rose from the sea, by its quick fanning motion temporarily taking the breath out of the bodies of the oarsmen. Next instant, the luckless mate, so full of furious life, was smitten boldly into the air, and, making a long arc in his descent, fell into the sea at the distance of about 50 yards. Not a chip of the boat was harmed, nor a hair of any oarsman's head, but the mate forever sank. It is well to parenthesize here that, of the fatal accidents in the sperm whale fishery, this kind is perhaps almost as frequent as any. Sometimes nothing is injured but the man who is thus annihilated. Oftener the boat's bow is knocked off, or the thigh-board, on which the headsmen stand, is torn from its place and accompanies the body. But strangest of all is the circumstance that, in more instances than one, when the body has been recovered, not a single mark of violence is discernible, the man being stark dead. The whole calamity, with the falling form of Macy, was plainly descried from the ship. Raising a piercing shriek, "The vial! The vial!" Gabriel called off the terror-stricken crew from the further hunting of the whale. This terrible event clothed the archangel with added influence because his credulous disciples believed that he had specifically foreannounced it instead of only making a general prophecy, which anyone might have done, and so have chanced to hit one of many marks in the wide margin allowed. He became a nameless terror to the ship. Mayhew, having concluded his narration, Ahab put such questions to him that the stranger captain could not forbear inquiring whether he intended to hunt the white whale, if opportunity should offer, to which Ahab answered, "Aye." Straightway then, Gabriel once more started to his feet, glaring upon the old man, and vehemently exclaimed with downward-pointed finger, "Think! Think of the blasphemer! Dead and down there! Beware of the blasphemer's end!" Ahab stolidly turned aside, then said to Mayhew, "Captain, I have just bethought me of my letter bag. There is a letter for one of thy officers, if I mistake not. Starbuck, look over the bag." Every whale ship takes out a goodly number of letters for various ships, whose delivery to the persons to whom they may be addressed depends upon the mere chance of encountering them in the four oceans. Thus, most letters never reach their mark, and many are only received after attaining an age of 2 or 3 years or more. Soon, Starbuck returned with a letter in his hand. It was sorely tumbled, damp, and covered with a dull, spotted green mold in consequence of being kept in a dark locker of the cabin. Of such a letter, Death himself might well have been the postboy.
"Canst not read it?" cried Ahab. "Give it me, man!" "Aye, aye, it's but a dim scrawl. What's this?"
As he was studying it out, Starbuck took a long, cutting spade pole, and with his knife slightly split the end to insert the letter there, and in that way hand it to the boat without its coming any closer to the ship. Meantime, Ahab, holding the letter, muttered,
"Mr. Yes, Mr. Harry—"
A woman's pinny hand, the man's wife, I'll wager.
"Aye, Mr. Harry Macy, ship Jeroboam. Why, it's Macy, and he's dead." "Poor fellow, poor fellow, and from his wife," sighed Mayhew. "But let me have it." "Nay, keep it thyself," cried Gabriel to Ahab. "Thou art soon going that way." "Curses throttle thee," yelled Ahab. "Captain Mayhew, stand by now to receive it."
And taking the fatal missive from Starbuck's hands, he caught it in the slit of the pole and reached it over towards the boat. But as he did so, the oarsman expectantly desisted from rowing. The boat drifted a little towards the ship's stern, so that, as if by magic, the letter suddenly ranged along with Gabriel's eager hand. He clutched it in an instant, seized the boat knife, and, impaling the letter on it, sent it thus loaded back into the ship. It fell at Ahab's feet. Then Gabriel shrieked out to his comrades to give way with their oars, and in that manner the mutinous boat rapidly shot away from the Pequod. As, after this interlude, the seamen resumed their work upon the jacket of the whale, many strange things were hinted in reference to this wild affair. The end of Chapter 71. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.